White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
And tonight, August 15th, 2013, we're bringing you Chapter 55 of this great and wonderful exposure, which is the great and wonderful gift that Henry Ford gave to the world. Isn't that right, Hadding?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I just really love this Henry Ford. The more I read this book and just thinking about what a great human being he was, he really was. People who would detract from him in any way are just missing the boat, I think. So we're going to be talking, this is a good chapter. It has some good stuff in it. You know, again, I think sometimes these writers just really hit the mark and say things that need to be seriously paid attention to. So what are we reading tonight, Hadding?
We're going to read about Rabbi Leo Levi, and he makes a lot of admissions about the fact that Jews are a race and things like that.
Yeah, right. And it's chapter 55, and yeah. It's called what?
B'nai B'rith leader discusses the Jews.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
To the pro-Jewish spokesmen who have filled the air with cries of lies and slander, to those self-appointed guardians of American ideals who rule out with rare finality all those who would dare suggest that possibly there is a hidden side of the Jewish question, it must come as something of a jolt to be reminded that in this series there is scarcely a line that is without high Jewish authority.
Well, there you go. They're always, every so often they want to remind everyone that they are speaking, what they're saying in here is not a bunch of slander and lies or anything, but it comes right from Jewish authorities themselves. Everything is spoke, has been said and done and written by Jews. I think they pretty much prove that.
Then in the next paragraph, they undermine that to some extent.
Well, yeah.
The protocols themselves are written for centuries in Jewish authoritative teachings and records. All the plans that have been described from time to time in these articles are written in the fundamental laws of the Jews. And all that the ancients have taught, the modern Jews have reaffirmed.
Okay, well, they say all the plans are written in the fundamental laws of the Jews. All the plans described from time to time in these articles.
Which means that you don't need the protocols.
Well, the protocols just reinforce, again, that this is what they're planning. But again, the protocols cannot be, you know, shown where they come from. So, therefore,
yes.
There's that.
If you're referencing the protocols, you're not referencing anything authoritative at all.
But they do fit with that, which isn't
authoritative. The writer of these articles has had to take constant counsel of prudence in his selection of material, for the Jews have always counted confidently on the fact that if the whole truth were told in one comprehensive utterance, no one would believe it. Thus, bigots and minds bursting with the discoveries that they have made have never been feared by the Jews. They counted on the incapacity of the non-Jews to believe or receive certain knowledge. They know that facts are not accepted on proof, but only on understanding. Non-Jews cannot understand why human beings should lend themselves to certain courses. They are, however, beginning to understand, and the proof is therefore becoming more significant.
Well, now maybe, but you know, I think the most important words in there, in that very good whole paragraph there, is that facts are not accepted on proof. They say that the Jews know that. They know that people don't go by facts. They go by what you know. We use lots of words for that, but they go by what they. Emotion or what they fear or what they want, what they wish.
It says understanding. In other words, I believe what it means is people tend to believe what makes sense to them. I think that's what it means.
That's very well put. Yeah, that's very well put. Yeah, you have to, it has to make sense. Once it makes sense to you, that's what people always say. Once you get it, you know, then you've got it and you don't lose it. But until you get it, yeah, you can be told and told and told and you don't hear it, and it's true.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense. That's very good. Because, you know, just like when you talk about, well, I won't bring up anything specific because you don't always agree with all that. But if you talk about certain things that have happened, and people will say, but how could that have happened? You know, I don't see how they could have done that. People would have known about it and so on, you know, and they just
I don't know anybody
won't,
says
you
that.
Know. Oh, they say that about 9/11. See, I didn't want to bring that up because you don't have the proper understanding of 9/11.
Yeah. I'm infidel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's good, you know, that we do have to present proof, but it doesn't move people whose minds are already set in a different way.
I thought a better example would be the Holocaust. I think people believe in the Holocaust because it makes sense to them.
It does make sense to them because they don't have any problem thinking that there are evil people in the world. There are evil regimes, and there have been a lot of evil regimes, and they don't have a problem thinking that the Hitler's ran an evil regime.
More fundamentally. There's something in them that has the inclination to do what that story represents. You see, it really says the belief in the Holocaust really says more about the people who believe in it than about those against whom the accusation is made.
Well, let's just go on.
There are yet more important revelations to be made. Always following closely the best Jewish sources. And when these revelations are made, it will be impossible for the Jewish leaders to keep silent or to deny. The time is coming for American Jewry to slough off the leadership which has led it and left it in the bog. Leadership knows that. Indeed, it is amazing to discover the number of indications that the attempts made to suppress the Dearborn Independent have been made principally to prevent the Jews reading it. The leaders do not care how many non-Jews read these articles, but they do not desire their own people to read them. The Jewish leaders do not desire their people's eyes to be opened. Why? Because just now, only Jews can truly know whether the statements made in these articles are true or not. Non-Jews may know here and there, as their observations may confirm the printed statements. But informed Jews really know, and large numbers of the masses of the Jews really know. When they see the truth in all its relationships in these articles, the hitherto led Jew may not be so tractable. Hence the effort to keep the non-Jewish point of view away from him.
Well, now this is really interesting and also very important what they're saying here. And It's like the Jews know what Jews are doing, but they don't want us to know, or they don't want us to know that they know. Either way, you know, and the Jews who are, but they're saying that the Jewish leaders don't want the ordinary Jews to read these articles because they think their eyes would be opened. Well, I think, don't you think their eyes are opened enough? I mean, they can't, in the Jewish press, you have all these stories all the time about what Jews are up to. But then you have the others, how they're being persecuted and so on. So, I think there's different people. It's not all this way, one way or the other. But the fact that they're saying that they don't care how many non-Jews read the International Jew, but they don't want Jews to read it. I don't know that that would be true today. Do you?
Well, I think whoever reads it, I mean, they don't like that. I mean, they would not like anybody to read this information, you know, if it's
right.
Persuasive.
Right.
But in particular, they don't want Jews to start, thinking about the hypocrisies of their own leadership and so forth.
Yeah, and that's why they probably go so far to demonize, like, say, this book. So that no Jews would even dare to even hold it in their hands, let alone read it, you know, because they've convinced them already that it's just hateful against Jews and by haters and so on and anti-Semitic. And so that way they won't read it to find out what's in it.
Yeah, they're worried to death about assimilation.
Yeah.
You know, which is one of the purposes that the Hola hoax serves, is to create a barrier between Jews and everybody else, so that the Jews are paranoid. They want to kill all the Jews. You know, mm-hmm. it helps with their solidarity.
Well, okay. a lot of people think that in effect that should happen, not actual killing if you can help it, but to get Jews out of our living spaces, absolutely,
yeah.
And everything, in which I agree with, but. You know, to Jews, that's the same thing as murdering them all.
Well, no, not really. Anyway.
Yeah,
Paul de Lagarde actually was the first one to suggest sending all the Jews to Madagascar. He suggested that in the 1880s.
Good for him.
In support of the statements that these articles have been based on Jewish authority, we quote today a series of declarations by one of the most able of the presidents of the B'nai B'rith, Leo N. Levy. Mr. Levy was American-born and died in 1904. He was a lawyer of distinction and attained the presidency of the International Jewish Order, B'nai B'rith, in 1900. He took part in the international politics of his people, and is credited with collaborating with Secretary of State John Hay on several important matters. The utterances here quoted were for the most part made while he was president of B'nai B'rith, but all of them were published the year after his death under B'nai B'rith auspices. There is therefore no question of their Jewishness.
Okay, I'll just stick in here what I looked him up to get find out a little few facts about him, and he was born in Texas and grew up in Texas, and then he went off east to go to school and all, and you know, he was from a well-to-do family and in the eastern coast part of Texas. Anyway, he is the one, you know, remember we read about Tsar Nicholas and the massacre at Kishinev and all these demands that the Jews were putting forth in the United States against Russia, saying they were abusing all their Jews and so on. And then they wanted all the, to open up the immigration so that all these Jews could come over to this country to get away from the pogroms and so on. Anyway, Levy penned a petition on July 4th, 1903, to Tsar Nicholas II after the massacre at Kishinev, and in with the demands that they stop abusing Jews. And Secretary of State John Hay signed his petition, and President Theodore Roosevelt endorsed it. So you see the kind of people that he was friendly with and hung out with. Or he didn't hang out with him, but, you know, they dealt with him some. And on January, as you said, he died in 1904. Anyway.
All right. Non-Jewish defenders of the Jewish program have pretended to much indignation because of references that have been made to the Oriental character of certain Jewish manifestations. By Oriental here, they mean Middle Eastern. What we
call them. Did you just turn something on? Oh, now it stopped.
Yeah.
Oh, no, there it is again. There's a kind of a background noise, but it's probably louder to me. It's not a problem. Go ahead.
Okay. The references in these articles have been two in number, once regarding Oriental sensuality as it has been introduced to the American stage by Jewish theatrical panderers, and again in quoting Disraeli, the Jew who became Premier of Britain, to the effect that the Jews, his people, were Mosaic Arabs. But it never seemed to have occurred to Leo N. Levi, or Levy, to deny the Oriental character of his race. Instead, he asserted it on page 104 of the B'nai B'rith Memorial. He excuses certain social crudities of the Jew on the ground that hailing originally from the Orient and having been compelled for 20 centuries to live in a society of his own, he has preserved in his taste much that is characteristically Oriental. Again, on page 116, he excused the multiplicity of religious rites as being due to the fact that the Jew drew upon his Oriental imagination for a symbolism that appealed to his ideal emotions. On page 312, he speaks of the Jews' Oriental devotion to their parents. This easy recognition of the fact is commended to those boot-licking editors who, out of the vastness of their ignorance of the Jewish question, have seen in the reference to Orientalism an insult to the Jews and an unfailing indication of anti-Semitism. The Jewish question. Ah, that is another point which pro-Jewish spokesmen hasten to deny, but they will be somewhat disturbed by the candor with which true Jewish spokesmen admit the question.
Well, you know, let me just say here that, you know, in some of the past chapters that we've read, particularly, I think, with ones dealing with the theater and so on, the international Jew goes into a lot of talk about the Oriental image, Oriental influence, and how bad it was for Anglo-Saxons, and you know how totally different and so on. And it's a lot of sensuality, and now they're tying this. They're getting they've got a good example, and well, they were probably criticized. See, when they say they're pointing out here that these ignorant editors and so on who say that that's anti-Semitic. So they probably got that criticism, and now they're pointing out that this high-level Jewish B'nai B'rith president said the very same thing about the Orientalism of the Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, very often, it happens that the vast majority of non-Jews just don't know the facts. Because Jews don't normally talk about certain things. So
well,
a few non-Jews find it out and talk about it, and all the other Gentiles say, oh, you're crazy. I never heard that before. And then some of the Jews will actually say that it's not true. But I told you before the show, you have to peel away the onion.
Yeah.
You get past, whenever there's something that's embarrassing to Jews, the first reaction from Jews generally will be denial. And then you show some evidence, and they'll say, well, it's true, but, right? But they knew all along that it was true.
That's right. That's the Orientalism.
Okay. In a strong passage on page 101, Mr. Levy says, If I have dwelt so long upon this subject, it is because I recognize that if the Jew has been denied so much that is rightfully his, he often claims more than his due. One of these claims most persistently urged is that there is no Jewish question, that a Jew is a citizen like any other citizen, and that as long as he abides by the law and does not subject himself to criminal prosecution or criminal action, his doings
civil
are
action.
Beyond...
Civil action.
His doings are beyond legitimate inquiry by the public at large. This contention on his part would certainly be well-based if he claimed nothing further than the right to live in peace. But when he demands social recognition, the whole range of his conduct is a legitimate subject of inquiry against which no technical demurrers can be interposed. Nor must the Jew be oversensitive about the inquiry. The inconsistencies and the unwisdom exhibited in the consideration of the Jewish question are not to be found altogether on the side of those who are hostile to the Jews.
Now that's a good statement, right?
Yeah.
See, he's more honest than most.
Yeah.
Because he hangs out in mixed company. You know, he's not just with Jews all the time.
Well, I think it's very important what you mentioned, that he's from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Southern Jew, probably Sephardic. Sephardic Jews in the South owned slaves, and that put them on the other side of the fence from a lot of the Jews up north that were Ashkenazi Jews that were very strongly, you know, into abolition of slavery and pushed civil rights and so forth. There's a bit of a division there between the Southern Jews, who are mostly Sephardic, and those Ashkenazi Jews up north.
Hmm.
Different perspective. The Sephardic Jews are regarded somewhat as aristocratic, actually, compared to Ashkenazi.
Right. And they go back further. They have more of a sense of their culture or something.
Yeah. Well, they're probably a little more assimilated. They've been here longer in the United States, that is.
Yeah, they've been everywhere.
And they existed among white people in as a much smaller minority than the Ashkenazim up north, who formed a big ghetto as soon as they arrived.
Right.
I read some blog by a Jew. What's his name? The name that he used on his blog is something like Cool Married Guy. Cool Married Guy. And he had a blog post on there where he was describing the behavior of some Orthodox Jews at a basketball game where an Israeli team played. And he seemed to be genuinely embarrassed by the behavior of these Jews. He was embarrassed. And he referred to himself as a white guy. He thinks of himself as a white guy.
Yeah, well, some Jews do. And they talk about that in this later on in this chapter, don't they? About how Jews act. It's not all that. It's not very, very nice. The majority of them.
Since then, the refugees from Russia, Galicia, and Romania have raised the Jewish question to commanding importance. Since then, it has dawned on the world that we are witnessing another exodus, which promises soon to change the habitat of the Jews to the Western Hemisphere. Page 59. The Jewish question cannot be solved by tolerance. There are thousands of well-meaning people who take to themselves great credit for exhibiting a spirit of tolerance toward the Jews. Page 98. Mr. Levy also lays down rules for the study of the Jewish question, and he says that if they were followed, the result would be startling at once to the Jews and the general public. Page 93. How far present Jewish leadership has departed from that frank and broad view taken by Mr. Levy is everywhere evident. Not that Mr. Levy was a critic of his people, but he was a lawyer who was accustomed to weighing facts, and he saw facts that weighed against his people. But he was pro-Jewish, even in his most severe observations. He could make an attack on the rabbis, taunting them with the saying that many of you are rabbis for revenue only. But he could also insist on Jewish solidarity and exclusiveness.
Well, that's true. You know, yeah, he is like that.
In this connection, it may be interesting to see how strongly Mr. Levy, I should pick one, shouldn't I, supports the contention of Jewish leaders as outlined in the Dearborn Independent of October 9th and 16th, 1920, that the Jews are a race and not merely a religion, a nation and not merely a church, and that the term Jew is biological rather than theological. This is especially commended to the attention of those dim-minded shouters of religious prejudice who come into action whenever the Jewish question is mentioned. Of religious prejudice, there are many examples to give in future articles. Certain it is thus far, the race and the religion have been so fused, as it were, that none can say just where the one begins and the other leaves off. Page 116. Attacking the contention of the liberals or reformed Jews, to the effect that Jew is the name of a member of a religious denomination and not a member of a certain race, Mr. Levy says, "Nothing to my mind is more pregnant with error than this postulate of unreason." Page 185. It is not true that the Jews are only Jews because of their religion. Page 189. The Jews are not simply an indiscriminate lot of people who hold to a common belief. Page 190.
Indiscriminate lot of people.
Yeah. A native Eskimo, an American Indian, might conscientiously adopt every tenet of the Jewish church, might practice every form and ceremony imposed by the Jewish laws and the Jewish ritual, and as far as the religion is concerned, be a Jew. But yet, no one who will reflect for a moment would class them with the Jews as a people. If the truth were known, a very large percentage of so-called Christians would be found to be believers in the essentials of the Jewish religion. And yet they are not Jews.
Well, you know, this idea of that you can't become a Jew by just joining the religion is makes a distinction between them and Christianity, which yeah. says you can become a Christian by just joining the religion. It doesn't matter, you know, anything else, nothing else about you matters.
Yeah,
which is what has destroyed Christianity, probably.
Yeah, there was some sort of a crisis in the history of Catholicism. I wish I could remember the details of it, but there was some kind of a controversy around the time of the Spanish exploration of the New World about whether the converts from the New World should be accepted into Catholicism on the same level as white people. And there was a real dispute about that.
That's good. That would be interesting to read about.
Yeah, I read about that once, and I never could find it again. It requires not only that men should believe in Judaism, this is to be a Jew, but that they should be the descendants in a direct line of that people who enjoyed a temporal government and who owned a country up to the time of the destruction of the Second Commonwealth.
That's debatable, isn't it? That they ever owned a country, but they act like they did.
They had Judea.
Well, they were the only people there, I guess, and nobody disputed it. So
that great event took away from the Jews their country and their temporal government. It scattered them over the face of the earth, but it did not destroy the national and race idea, which was a part of their nature and of their religion. Who shall say, then, that the Jews are no longer a race? Blood is the basis and substratum of the race idea, and no people on the face of the globe can lay claim with so much right to purity of blood and unity of blood as the Jews. If I have reasoned to any purpose, the inquiry of rights in the premises is not to be limited to Jews as exponents of a particular creed, but to the Jews as a race. Pages 190-191. The religion alone does not constitute the people. As I have already maintained, a believer in the Jewish faith does not by reason of that fact become a Jew. On the other hand, however, a Jew by birth remains a Jew, even though he abjures his religion. Page 200.
Now, you know, Cam was talking about this Tuesday night, and his concluding remark was that the Jews are a people, not a religion. You know, and that's pretty much what they're saying, what this guy's saying right here.
Well,
they are a group of people who come together for the reasons that they do. And religion is only only part of it.
If you're talking about a particular population of Jews, like Ashkenazi Jews, they are highly inbred, which means that they have hereditary tendencies that are very hard to eliminate. So if they convert to some creed other than Judaism, they will still in many ways behave like Jews and think like Jews. See, there's a problem though with talking about the racial unity of Jews, and when you think about the fact that there are Negro Jews in Africa and Chinese Jews that look for all the world, to us at least, like Chinese. So it's really more complicated than that. But
yeah, but you know, what kind of Jews are these people? They're just, for some reason, they got converted to Judaism. And so they call themselves Jews. I mean, how consciously are they actually about being Jewish?
Yeah, in the case of the Lemba Jews in southern Africa who look like Negroes.
Well, they are. Yeah.
Let me finish, please. Yeah. And the Chinese Jews, they've done genetic testing on them that showed the presence of the what they call the Cohen Y chromosome. And, you know, that's supposed to authenticate them as a Jewish population, at least in terms of male ancestry. But it's some Jews went to those places and picked up a lot of the local genetic material, you know, by intermarrying. That's what happened.
Well, so, yeah, it would have to.
And I wouldn't be surprised if that's also true in the case of Ashkenazi Jews, because I tell you what, have you looked at the picture of that Chechen, the Dzhokhar Tsarnaev?
Yeah.
It kind of looks like Bob Dylan, you know?
The older one. You mean the younger one?
Well, there's a picture, yeah.
The younger one? Well, yeah. Well, those, you know, a lot of those people have that same look. You know,
Chechnya is like area. From the very southern border of what used to be Khazaria. You know,
uh-huh.
So
yeah,
he's got some kind of genetic kinship with Jews there, with Ashkenazi Jews anyway.
Not at all surprising.
So continuing, this is the view of such men. It's referring back to what Levi said about the fact that the Jews are always a Jew, no matter if they change religion. This is the view of such men as Justice Brandeis, the Jew who sits on the Supreme Court of the United States. Justice Brandeis says, "Let us all recognize that we Jews are a distinct nationality of which every Jew whatever his country, his station, his shade of belief, is necessarily a member. Believing all this, Mr. Levi subscribes to the Jewish law and practice of exclusiveness. Describing the state of the Jews, Mr. Levi says, page 92, "The Jews have not materially increased or diminished in numbers for 2,000 years. They have made no proselytes to their religion. They have imbibed the arts, the literature, and the civilization of successive generations, but have abstained very generally from intermixture of blood. They have infused their blood into that of other peoples, but have taken little of other peoples into their own." See, I just addressed that. That's hogwash, actually.
Would have to be, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
He's imagining something here.
The Jews have this doctrine that says they're the seed of Abraham, which means that they're a descent group. So in that sense, they could be considered a race, but the proposition that they haven't taken up, you know, the genetic material of populations among which they lived to a very great degree in some cases, that's just not true.
Mm-hmm. There are some of those ultra-Orthodox. I think they probably haven't, because they've been very, very careful never to mix with anything or anybody. But when you get out into all those others, it wouldn't be true. But I do hate thinking about all this mixing, because then it means, you know, it works all ways, you know. Anyway.
Well, the bright side is that the part Jews, this is according to something I was translating recently, the mixed marriages tend not to produce many children. The mixed race people.
Yeah, that's
have
it.
Fewer
those,
children.
Yeah, yeah, and these ultra Orthodox, they're the ones that have 12 kids and stay very close together.
As to intermarriage between the Jew and non-Jew, Mr. Levi calls it miscegenation.
Isn't that funny? That's really amazing. He really uses that word.
In remote countries, sparsely populated, the choice may lie between such marriages and a worse relation. Those are his words on page 249. He does not advise the worse relation, but has said quite enough to indicate the Jewish view of the case. He continues, "It seems clear to me that Jews should avoid marriages with Gentiles and Gentiles with Jews upon the same principle that we avoid marrying the insane, the consumptive, the scrofulitic, or the Negro," page 249.
What do you think of that?
Well, Jews all have some Negro in them, whether they realize it or not. There's a book called The Genetics of the Jews by A.E. Morant, Morant, who was a Jew himself. And he finds that all Jewish populations have about 5% Negro genes.
But
European Jews, probably. Yeah,
of course. Well, but to say, come up right out and say that we shouldn't marry Gentiles in the same sense that we shouldn't marry insane or consumptive people or Negroes. Yeah. What if a white person? What if a Gentile said that about the Jews? It would be just considered horrible. That's a really extreme statement, but does anybody pay attention to it? Well, because everything's controlled by Jews. You know, the information is all controlled by Jews, the media.
Well, he has in that paragraph, he endorses the idea that Gentiles should avoid marriage with Jews on the same principle. Maybe that's just a little bit of window dressing in case some goyim should happen to read what he wrote. But basically he's saying what's good for the goose is good for the gander there as far as white non-Jews go.
Well, that is his basic attitude throughout most of this, yes. You're right. Okay.
This exclusiveness goes down through all human relations. The Jew has one counsel for non-Jews and another for himself in these matters. Of the non-Jew, he demands as a right what he looks down upon as shady privilege. He uses the ghetto as a club with which to bludgeon the non-Jew for his bigotry, when as a fact he chooses the ghetto for well-defined racial reasons. He condemns the non-Jew for the exclusion of the Jew from certain sections of society, when as a Jew his whole care is to keep himself unspotted from that very society to which he seeks entrance. The Jew insists on breaking down non-Jewish exclusiveness while keeping his own. The non-Jewish world is to be public and common. The Jewish world is to be kept sacrosanct. Read the teachings of this enlightened leader of Jewry as published by the B'nai B'rith. He favors the public school for non-Jewish children, not for Jewish children. They are to be kept separate. They are the choice stock of the earth. Because the government tenders free education, it does not follow that it must be accepted. If education be made compulsory, it does not follow that government schools must be attended. As a citizen, I favor free schools because the education they afford, imperfect as it is better than none, and society is benefited thereby. But as an individual, I prefer to pay to support free schools and send my children to more select places, page 253. He speaks of the fact that all classes of children frequent the public schools as an argument against the Jewish children going there. In my judgment, Jewish children should be educated in Jewish schools, page 254. Not only is it a positive and direct advantage to educate our children as Jews, but it is absolutely necessary to our preservation. Experience has shown that our young people will be weaned from our people if allowed indiscriminately to associate with the Gentiles, page 255. Discussing the possibility of Jews losing their crudeness, Mr. Levi asks, how shall we best accomplish that end? Then he quotes the frequent answer, since the exemplars of gentility most abound among the Gentiles, we should associate with them as much as possible, in order to wear away our own rudeness. He meets the suggestion this way. If gentlemen were willing to meet all Jews on a parity, because they are Jews, we should doubtless derive much benefit from such association. But while it is true that no gentleman refuses association with another because that other is a Jew, he will not, as a rule, associate with a Jew unless he be a gentleman. As we are far from being all gentlemen, we cannot reasonably expect to be admitted as a class into good society. So, better to keep by ourselves, concludes Mr. Levi.
See, he's not saying that you're going to turn all the Jews into gentlemen. Of course, you never turn all of any group into gentlemen, the way he's speaking about it. But it's like they don't even care that they're not. So that's why another reason they have to keep to themselves.
That is, Mr. Levi admits the willingness of society to meet Jews on equal terms as with all others, but not on unequal terms. And this being so, Mr. Levi holds they had better meet as little as possible. They had better keep apart. In the formative years, certainly, Jewish young people should be kept rigidly apart from non-Jews. The exclusiveness of which the Jews complain is their own. The ghetto is not a corner into which the non-Jews have herded the Semites. The ghetto is a spot carved out of the community and consecrated to the chosen people, and is therefore the best section of the city in Jewish eyes, the rest being the Christian quarter, the area of the heathen. Mr. Levi himself admits on page 220 that there is no prejudice against the Jew in this country. Certain wild-eyed objectors to the series of studies on the Jewish question have made the assertion that the Dearborn Independent has declared cowardice to be a Jewish trait. That the statement is false as regards this paper does not change the fact that the subject has been generally discussed in and out of army circles. If it ever becomes necessary to discuss it in these studies, the facts will be set forth as far as they are obtainable. But the point just now is that Mr. Levi has had somewhat to say, which may repay reading. Physical courage has always been an incident, not an element of Jewish character. It has no independent existence in their makeup and always depended on something else. With some exceptions, this may be said of all Oriental people. The sense and fear of danger is highly developed in them, and there is no cultivation of that indifference to it which has distinguished the great nations of Western Europe, page 205. Aristotle, I think, says something similar.
Yes, well, I didn't know that, but I think that's very important, some important ideas he's putting forth there, and a lot of truth about it. So the Oriental thing is to kind of see danger and, you know, problems everywhere, and unlike the Western European, who kind of goes around fearless and indifferent to such things.
Yeah, well, for Aristotle, it was the courageous Greek versus the cowardly Near Easterner, Persian subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Were a non-Jew to call attention to this difference between the Jews and others, he would be met with the cry of anti-Semitism, and he would be twitted with the fact that all his relatives may not have served in the war. Loudest to twit him would be those who served in what our soldiers called the Jewish infantry, the quartermaster's corps in the late National Army. I assume that the quartermaster's corps was a place where Jews could get business contracts for other Jews.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
It is to this aversion to danger, however, that Mr. Levi attributes the Jews' greatness among the nations. Other nations can fight, the Jews can endure, and that, he says, is greater. Note his words. The italics are his own. Ooh, I have to speak in italics now. Other nations may boast conquests and triumphs born of aggression, but though the fruits of victory have been manifold, they have not been enduring. And it may be truly said that the nation whose greatness grows out of valor passes through the stages of discord and degeneracy to decay. In the virtue of endurance, I believe the Jews have a safeguard against the decay that has marked the history of all other peoples.
Huh, I think that's an odd way of putting it. I don't think that's very good reasoning, but anyway. He's right about the enduring part. They do endure. They do have that.
It appears, therefore, that the draft dodger, if he can endure long enough, may yet come to own the country. Jewish leaders have lately tried to minimize as wild words the disclosures made by Disraeli with reference to the Jews' participation in European revolutions. What Disraeli said can be found in his Coningsby, or in the quotations made therefrom in the Dearborn Independent of December 18, 1920. With reference to the German Revolution of 1848, Disraeli wrote, before it had taken place, "You never observe a great intellectual movement in Europe in which the Jews do not greatly participate. that mysterious Russian diplomacy, which so alarms Western Europe, is organized and principally carried on by Jews. That mighty revolution, which is at this moment preparing in Germany, and which will be, in fact, a second and greater reformation, and of which so little is yet known in England, is entirely developing under the auspices of Jews. It is interesting, therefore, to hear Mr. Levi confirming from the American side those significant statements made by Disraeli. The revolution of 1848 in Germany, however, influenced a great many highly educated Jews to come to America, page 181. It is unnecessary to review the events of 1848. Suffice it to say that not a few among the revolutionists were Jews, and that a considerable number of those who were proscribed by the government at home fled to the United States for safety, page 182. These German Jews are now the arch financiers of the United States. They found here complete liberty to exploit peoples and nations to the full extent of their powers. They still maintain their connections with Frankfurt on the Main, the world capital of international financial Jewry. With these quotations from the speeches and writings of Leo N. Levi, a famous president of the B'nai B'rith, it would seem to be a fair question as to the reason for the denial and denunciation which have followed the making of these statements in the course of this series of studies. Leo N. Levi studied the Jewish question because he knew a Jewish question to exist. He knew that the Jewish question was not a non-Jewish creation, but appeared wherever Jews began to appear in numbers. They brought it with them. He knew the justice of many of the charges laid against the Jews. He knew the impossibility of disproving them, the futility of shrieking anti-Semitism at them. He knew, moreover, that for the Jews to solve the Jewish question by departing from the peculiar racial traditions of superiority would be to cease to be Jews. Therefore, he threw his whole influence on the side of the Jews remaining separate, maintaining their tradition of the chosen race, looking upon themselves as the coming rulers of the nations. And there he left the question just about where he found it. But in the course of his studies, he gave other investigators the benefit of his frank statements. He did not put lies into the mouths of his people. He was not endeavoring to maintain himself in position by prejudiced racial appeals. He looked certain facts in the face, made his report, and chose his side. Several times in the course of his argument, his very logic led him up to the point where, logically, he would have to cast aside his Jewish idea of separateness. But with great calmness, he discarded the logic and clung to the Jewish tradition. For example, the better to facilitate such happiness in every country and in every age, various kinds of organizations have existed as they exist today. The Jews have theirs. For many reasons, they are exclusive. In theory, they should not be so. In our social organizations, we should, in deference to the argument which I have already named, admit any congenial and worthy Gentile who honors us with his application. But what may be theoretically correct may be found practically wrong. It certainly is a wrong to exclude a worthy person because he does not happen to be a Jew. But on the other hand, where are you to draw the line? This is frankness to a fault. Of course, it is wrong, But the right is impractical. Logic goes by the boards in the face of something stronger. Mr. Levi is not to be blamed for having gone to his tribe. Every man's place is with his tribe. The criticism belongs to the lickspittle Gentile fronts who have no tribe and become hangers-on around the outskirts of Judah. Racial mongrels who would be better off if they had 1/1000th of the racial sense which the Jew possesses.
Well, here he's coming on real strong with racialist thinking and language, isn't he? That's good.
This brief survey of the philosophy which Mr. Levi both lived and taught, and which is shared by the leaders of American Jewry, is in strict agreement with Jewish principles all down the centuries. In his published addresses, Mr. Levi does not touch upon all the implications of the separateness which he enjoins upon his nation. Why do they keep by themselves? What is it that keeps them distinct? Is it their religion? Very well, let us regard them as a sect of religious recluses and wish them well in their endeavors to keep themselves unspotted of the world. Is it their race? So their leaders teach. Race and nationality are strictly claimed. If this is so, there must be a political outlook. What is it, Palestine? Not that anyone can notice. A great deal may be read about it in the newspapers in turn being supplied through the Associated Press with the Jewish Telegraph Agency's propaganda dispatches. But no one in Palestine notices the land becoming more Jewish. Jewry's political outlook is world rule in the material sense. Jewry is an international nation. It is this and nothing else which gives significance to its financial, educational, propagandist, revolutionary, and immigration programs.
Very good. What good timing. Okay, that was in 14th of May, 1921, in the Dearborn Independent. Well, I found this very ending very interesting. Jewry's political outlook is world rule in the material sense. Well, he's coming back around to the protocols that he started with without actually mentioning them. But the same kind of thing, and that Jewry is international, in spite of all their seeming racial and their seeming nationalism. Last words, Hadding?
Well, there are a couple of things that people could nitpick in here. I think we already had a chapter where they talked about the Jews, Zionists, trying to take over Palestine. And, you know.
Well, that's the Zionists, but that's not really what was going on with these American Jews so much.
Yeah, I would also like to point out that a number of European nations are at least as ancient as the Jews. The Germans, you know, we don't have anything about Jews prior to probably about the Roman period anyway, the Roman Empire. And we have information on the Germans going farther back than that. People will argue that there's some Egyptian inscription referring to the Hebrew, but we don't know that that's really Jews.
Okay, and that's it for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. See you next week. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.